Hey, this is David Green. I'm the co-founder of Fearless Media, and I am your host here on Left, Right, and Center. This is the show where we take on all of the political issues, even the complicated ones that might be dividing your own family these days. So Ukraine observed its Independence Day this week in the middle of a brutal war with a country that denies its independence. We're 6 months in now since Russia's invasion in February, but many Ukrainians will say that this war has been going on for years now, since Russia illegally annexed Crimea and invaded Ukraine's east in 2014. And that really is the important context for President Biden's big announcement this week of $3 billion in aid to help Ukraine buy more weapons, to try at least to keep them firmly in the fight. Now, unless Ukraine somehow wins and repels Russia altogether, which sadly seems unlikely anytime soon, this war could simmer on for who knows how long. And that might, sadly, be Russian President Vladimir Putin's goal. So how long can President Biden keep sending help? Will the American public at some point lose interest in this war? And will new faces in Congress and maybe the White House mean Ukraine is eventually abandoned? Well, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. I am your host at the center. On the left, we have Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. On the right, we're joined by Tim Carney, columnist at The Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And I'm also going to bring in our special guest now. It's Dr. Evelyn Farkas. She's the executive director at the McCain Institute, also former deputy assistant secretary of defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. Greetings to everyone.
Hi there.
Hey, David.
Thank you.
Evelyn, I want to start with you if I can. I know you obviously follow this conflict in Ukraine very closely. Let's start with how you see history books recording what we are seeing happen there right now.
Well, I think, David, in your opening, you were really accurate in reflecting how the Ukrainian people see the war. And I hope that most other people will also see the war as something that was started by the Russians without provocation in August of 2014. And it, you know, goes back to the Ukrainian people essentially determining that they wanted to become more democratic, that they wanted to associate themselves with the European Union, indeed to get their country as included as a member of the Union, as well as a member of NATO, something that their previous leadership, which was very much Kremlin-controlled, Kremlin-friendly, did not like. The people went to the streets. The transition government was negotiated with multiple countries involved, including ours and Russia, and elections were held. The elected, you know, freely elected government of Ukraine from 2014 onwards has been on a trajectory to include, to make sure that Ukraine is part of the Western European alliance network, so the democratic network of states. And that's something that Russia has resisted all along under the leadership of President Putin. And President Putin tried in 2014 with the initial invasion and seizure of Crimea to stop all of this.
Right.
But what he found out was that it wasn't working. And that's why he caused this new invasion. And this phase is really, truly brutal and shocking because it's playing out, you know, on television screens all over the world.
Well, you wrote back in March that the United States should not be living in this constant fear of a wider war with Russia. You said, quote, "There is no automatic escalation from one Russian aircraft down by a NATO fighter to full-blown war." Calling obviously for more from the United States than what the U.S. has been doing. We have this new package from President Biden. It lets Ukraine buy weaponry, but doesn't seem to go nearly as far as you were calling for. So where are you on this now in terms of U.S. support?
Well, I think that we've come a lot farther from where we were when I wrote that op-ed, meaning the United States government is now providing advanced weaponry to Ukraine. Ukraine's neighbors are now providing some aircraft, attack aircraft, so fighters of the old Soviet variety to Ukraine, which was something that was also ridiculously considered, you know, escalatory in the past. So we have come farther, but I have to say that all along, and this goes back to the administration I was in, the Obama administration, through the Trump administration to the present day, there's been this very incremental, cautious approach, you know, provide the Ukrainians with what they need to not lose the war, but it's not been enough, as you pointed out in the beginning, for them to actually win the war. And I do think that if we ramp up what we're providing the Ukrainians and we take advantage of Russian weakness right now, the Ukrainians actually can take back their territory. But we need to provide them with
all of
more
it?
Assistance.
I mean, the East, Crimea, like you think that Ukraine could actually get all of it back and quote unquote win?
I think they can if we provide them. But again, with the caveat that we have to provide them with ample assistance quickly. And the assistance has to include not just weaponry, but intelligence, advice, and no rules, like you can't attack Russian, legitimate Russian military targets in Russia. I mean, they're launching their war from Russian territory. It should not be considered somehow illegitimate to use Western weaponry against Russian military targets in Russia when they're being used anyway against Russian military targets in Ukraine. So there are things we can do to help the Ukrainians really turn the tide.
Tim, are you open to ample assistance to help Ukraine turn the tide and get closer to something called a victory?
I think it's good that we are helping. I'm skeptical that the war is winnable at all. And what we always have to remember is that no two nations will ever have identical interests, and that Ukraine's interests and our interests are not identical. And that what we've been getting sometimes in the U.S. media, not I'm saying from Evelyn at all, but sometimes people who just see Ukraine's a good guy, and so we should be doing what they want, because what they want is to defeat the aggressor. Sure. But
I mean, what's not
limit.
True about that?
And that's true. That's absolutely true,
okay.
Except within limits. I'm only willing to go so far to defeat the aggressor. And the idea of U.S. missiles going into the territory of Russia to destroy military targets, I understand the rationale. But if Russian missiles went into the U.S. into NATO territory, that would be considered an act of war against us and all NATO members. So are we really willing to do the others? I just think that triggering an escalation, getting the U.S. too intimately involved in something that is not directly in our interest. It's in the interest of all democratic nations that Ukraine repel this invasion, but there's no direct U.S. interest. I really always want to be pulling on the side of caution. I actually have praised Joe Biden for being more cautious here than I expected him to. And we just really need to always realize that war can escalate. And that's what we have to be worried about.
Evelyn, I mean, does Tim have a point? I mean, firing into Russia could spark something larger. And why couldn't Russia then, you know, fire something into like U.S. territory or into NATO
Again,
countries?
Well, first of all, escalation is not automatic. And I mean, I have
possible,
many points.
Right?
To make here. It's possible, but Vladimir Putin is in no position to wage war against NATO. I mean, he does all this nuclear blustering too. It's all overwrought because right now, Russia cannot win a war against Ukraine. There is no rational reason, and don't tell me he's not rational, for the Russian government and Vladimir Putin to want to take on a war with NATO. But what I will say to Tim's point is I think it's not I understand what he's saying about obviously being cautious and not wanting to be dragged into a direct conflict with Russia. I'm not advocating for that by any means. But I do think that we need to do more because I see the situation slightly differently. If we don't defeat Putin right now in Ukraine, we will be fighting him to defend one of our Baltic or Poland or one of our NATO allies.
You think he'll gain confidence and be emboldened and maybe go to Estonia?
Absolutely. And I know, and I've read, you know, I've studied this man, this regime, so I am very confident in my belief that if he succeeds, he will not stop. He may rest, but he won't stop.
Liz, I want to bring you in here, Liz.
The idea that Putin is in no position to win a war against, you know, essentially the United States, if we were to take up this super aggressive form of aid to Ukraine, which essentially translates into the U.S. declaring war on Russia, you know, via proxy, it's not only a question of could Putin take on the United States, it's a question of could the United States take on Putin. And, you know, just because he could not triumph doesn't mean that it would leave us in a considerably better position. And we also stand to lose quite a bit. You know, there's such a thing as a Pyrrhic victory, and we have just exited another 20-year conflict that just drained the United States of so much more than money. And I mean, you know, the nuclear bluster is bluster for now, but it's been a long time and we were the last one to light that match. I don't know. I'm sort of with Tem. I really don't want to edge any closer to escalation on this.
So where should the United States stop? I mean, is $3 billion more in military aid a good idea? Or do you even worry that that's heading closer to escalation?
We need to cancel Ukraine's foreign debts. We need to accept refugees quite liberally. We need to offer humanitarian aid. I mean, I agree with Evelyn's point that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to provide just enough aid to continue this sort of low-boiling conflict that's just a humanitarian crisis, but not a serious problem in terms of confrontation for Russia, because it only makes things worse for the people living in Ukraine without actually concluding the conflict. But I think that only points to this sort of drip of aid being an issue. And I can't support escalation. So, I think it's time to start focusing on humanitarian interventions and diplomatic solutions primarily.
But, I have this struggle because I can sit here in the United States and have this conversation with all of you about sort of like where are the limits of U.S. and NATO engagement and how is this going to end and could it go on forever and maybe it's not worth fighting. And then you go to Ukraine, and I spent a few months there on a reporting project this year, and you listen to Ukrainians, you can't find a single Ukrainian who is in favor of some sort of compromise. They're like, even in the East, even in Donbass. There's some supporters of Russian Donbass and Russian speakers, but largely, and I think even in growing numbers, even in the East now, it's like this message of this is my home. I am going to stay here. I'm going to fight for my house and my home, and we need all the support we can get from the world because we're on the front lines of something bigger. And I don't know how to sort of deal with those two separate priorities, because Henry Kissinger years ago, in 2014 actually, said yes. That like Ukraine will always be the tug of war between East and West. Neither side will ever win. And it's ridiculous to make this about some larger existential battle between, good and evil. Is that a reality that Ukrainians and all of us need to face?
No, because first of all, as you pointed out, and you can tell Henry Kissinger yourself, the Ukrainian people have a vote in this. It's their lives, and they refuse to put down their guns. I am not advocating, we are already in a proxy war, but it's indirect. I am not advocating for direct action unless Putin uses a nuclear weapon, frankly. In that case, that regime cannot stay in power, and then we need to use all of our means, political, diplomatic, military, whatever, to get rid of a regime that would have used nuclear weapon in anger for the first time since World War II. So I'm not in favor of direct war with Russia, but indirectly we need to do more. And this is very different from Afghanistan. One of the major reasons is exactly what you pointed out, David, that the Ukrainian people are fully behind this and they are fighting. It's existential for them. They are fighting for their right to exist. All you have to do is go back and read Eastern European history, read Tim Snyder's Bloodlands. The Russians for a long time have resisted the idea, some Russians, of Ukrainian nationhood. And unfortunately, Putin is very much reviving the Stalin-esque, neo-imperial push to brutally remove Ukraine from the map.
But doesn't
and
Liz have a point?
It's not something can accept internationally, not just from the perspective of European security.
Doesn't Liz have a point about fatigue, though? And about, at some point, if this goes on for years and years, the U.S. public getting tired and it not being something that is in the U.S. interest to keep, funding a war that, if Putin has his way, could just sort of simmer on for years.
Right now, we can afford it economically. So I don't know what we're being fatigued about. Yes, people might get impatient because there's no resolution quickly. And I understand that. And I do think it's up to our leaders, our government and others, to explain, like myself, to explain what's at stake here. And if we can continue to explain what's at stake to the American people and they understand, then they will support it.
I just don't see why we have a single American child living in poverty or a single American mother who cannot give birth in a hospital or a single American child who cannot go to the doctor if we're giving $3 billion in aid to the Ukraine. I'm sorry. I don't understand it.
So, Liz,
one can make that trade-off, though. We would all love to make that trade-off, but that's not how the budget works, and that's not how our government works.
I would just add that you can tell these stories about
about Ukrainian bravery and Ukrainian suffering and how righteous their cause is. And it still doesn't paint a picture for why exactly it's worth the risks for America, the costs that Liz is pointing out and the risks that we're both pointing out for the U.S. to be involved in this. And so that is and we know that there are the abstract ideas. Well, a country shouldn't be allowed to invade another country. I absolutely agree with that. But that's not something, there's a limit to the price. And I'm focusing mostly on the risk of escalation, but there's also costs. There's also our military's attention, all of that. There's a limit to what we're willing to do to uphold an abstract idea like this when there's no direct attack on U.S. interests or people.
We absolutely have control over how we allocate GDP. What do you mean that's not how the budget works? The budget's controlled legislatively. We have control over how the budget works. This is something that we can do.
Yes, but politically, if you understand how the politics work, it's not a trade-off that anyone makes directly.
A trade-off people will make because of the military-industrial complex and like the control that lobbyists who are representing defense companies have over Congress.
Yes, and also the need to defend our country.
Liz, can I ask you, defend
our country from what? Putin's attack on Ukraine?
Liz, what would you tell a Ukrainian who you were staring into their face and they said, we need this money to keep buying weapons to keep us there? And you were advocating for saying, you know what? This money should be going to other causes in the United States.
I was just in a room with an autopsy with a dead man who'd been tortured to death by the United States government, and the Alabama Department of Corrections won't admit it. He was a poor man. He grew up in a very poor place in my country, in Alabama. I've also been to the Mississippi Delta to see a man executed. I'm extremely sorry in solidarity to you. About what's happening in your country. We also have extremely poor, desperate people dying in poverty and being tortured to death by my government in my country. That's what I'd say.
All right. Well, we are going to leave it there. Obviously, there's a lot more to talk about when it comes to Ukraine. I'll be back with Elizabeth Brunig, Tim Carney, and Evelyn Farkas. We're going to talk about state secrets at Mar-a-Lago. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
We're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I am David Green, the co-founder of Fearless Media. In your center position on the left, we're joined by Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic, and we have Tim Carney, columnist at The Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And we have Evelyn Farkas with us. She's executive director at the McCain Institute and former deputy assistant secretary of defense. So it's been 2 weeks now since the FBI's Mar-a-Lago moment. They left with 24 boxes of presidential records that should have been returned to the National Archives and the Records Administration. But on Tuesday of this week, the Archives actually released a letter about other materials entirely. There were these 700 pages of classified materials that were at Mar-a-Lago before being recovered this past January. Some were top secret, some related to, quote, special access programs, which are among the country's most secretive intelligence operations. Evelyn, let me start with you. As a former official in the Defense Department, how serious is it that these 700 pages of materials were missing in at Mar-a-Lago for a while?
Okay, David, I feel like every time we have these conversations about something that the former president did, we have to say it's unprecedented, it's shocking, I don't have adjectives. I mean, I am somebody who, I think I still have an active security clearance, although I haven't used it for anything lately.
But you can give it to us if you want. I mean, you can just hand it over. Yeah, we're happy to use it.
But I've had access to special access programs. I did oversight for 7 years of the special operations community. I ran a commission on WMD, proliferation and terrorism. These compartmented programs, first of all, it's enough to call them TSSCI. So they're all top secret, and how we got the information is also classified, right? But on top of that, they're even in a special category. So the number of people can be listed on a sheet of paper. And the fact that he had them in a civilian place, the Mar-a-Lago, where he could have brought any kind of foreigner in or non-cleared American,
to see lists of names, you're saying, and people who could be at risk?
Yes. I mean, I find it completely shocking. And I mean, I have to be honest, you know, while he was in government, I thought he was a security risk to begin with, because he would call people on his cell phone, and he told Lavrov in the White House, the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador at the time, you know, he gave away state secrets at that moment about what Israel had done to help us foil a terrorist plot. So, you know, this is, I'll just stop there.
Liz, do you have adjectives for this moment?
I mean, I'm very, very curious to know more. I'm interested in, as always, whether, you know, he was aware of the extent of the malfeasance here, or if he was unaware. I'm not sure which is sort of more comical to me. Either way, you know, just sort of increasing disturbing levels of either incompetence or malice. I think, you know, the upshot has been the conservative response, which has been to say the DOJ and FBI are nefarious liars. I've got about 40,000 cannabis convictions that would like a word. If you'd like to take that route, I'd be more than happy to take you up on that, turn a few people loose.
But you are saying that it's possible that there was like not something nefarious here that Trump was doing, that maybe these boxes showed up because aides brought it, or it was just something stupid.
I mean, the whole operation seems incredibly shoddy and almost slapstick in nature.
Which is not a good thing. I'm not suggesting that's okay, but it's different than having some plans to give nuclear secrets away.
Right. You're like you have like your casino operation and your children running your presidential administration. You know, it's like the kind of gang you'd bring in to run a restaurant when you're trying to run a government. So I can understand just some absolutely ridiculously stupid stuff happening in that context that isn't necessarily, a sophisticated spy plot, but rather the opposite.
It's my wife owns a restaurant. It's very hard to run a restaurant, too.
I don't know about it. Maybe harder than running a country at some point.
Think about this. Think about the average people who people bring in to try to run a restaurant. Not the ones that succeed, but simply all the ones that begin and fail.
I'm going to let you sit down with my wife at some point and talk that out.
Does your wife's restaurant serve taco bowls is my question.
Or beautiful chocolate cake.
A lot of Donald Trump's critics on the left, on the shows I would go on MSNBC, wanted to posit that there was some like compromat that Putin had on him, or that he had these, you know, conspiracies to do what. And nowadays it's, oh, he was going to sell the nuclear secrets. That is not by any means the most likely story.
And I'm gonna make it, but it's possible, right?
It's possible, yeah. This man has no moral compass at all. But I think that the main character flaw that explains what he did here is that he never saw a difference between his own personal interests and his role in the office. He's a man who ran a small business that he owned entirely. He didn't even have shareholders to answer to, right? So if it was the company's, it was his. He never saw a distinction, and that was the way he treated the U.S. government. And so now
that's not good.
That's not good. But no. I'm going to say why it's almost precedented is because the same exact thing that I said about Hillary Clinton and her emails, but her emails, yes, applies here. It's worse here because Trump was actually president and he took the documents off campus. But what happened was the worry about what was classified or what was secret is legitimate, but really the offense, and if you look at the FBI affidavit, you look at the crimes that they were investigating, the parts of the espionage they were investigating wasn't espionage, right? It was about him taking stuff that wasn't his, him making decisions about what he was going to keep, what was a public record, what was going to turn over. The same things that Hillary did when she decided to move all her emails to where she got to control
but
what
hang
went
on a
to
second.
The archives.
With the emails,
he was making that same decision.
Wait, the emails, many of them could have been classified, and they were emails. It was not clear what was classified, what wasn't. Most of that was like, this could have, yes, I agree, like a security breach.
She also didn't refuse, David, to return them for a year.
But we don't know.
These were classified documents, clearly marked, that were removed from the White House and put in a mansion in Florida. Like, I just, that comparison is a distraction.
I mean, yes. The point I'm making is this, that I think that even Trump's critics are and I'm one of them on this particular case, but we're getting off topic
if we focus too much on what's classified instead of, and this is my own bias as a journalist who believes deeply in government accountability, instead of the fact that it's not up to him to decide what he gets to keep, what he has to turn over to the archives. Even when he was the president, that wasn't his decision to decide what was a presidential record or what he got to keep. And that is where I would focus.
Because, yes.
And that is where the FBI is focusing. And it's kind of titillating to say, oh, there's going to be some nuclear secret in there. We don't have evidence of that.
Well, you have to know the
but
risk.
But isn't it raising the risk that, yes, Evelyn, the risk is worth investigating, is it not? What
yes,
could be in
yes.
there and what the dangers could be? I'd rather investigate that now than 7 years from now when we actually find out that there was
yeah,
something
Yeah, but if you find out that there was nothing there, he's going to declare himself vindicated, that it was all just like personal letters and that sort of stuff. But instead, let's focus today on you. This isn't your own personal property, dude. You were the president of the United States and this was the United States. This belonged to the office of the presidency or to the U.S. government. That was a distinction he never got. That's why he took these documents. If you start attacking him on some speculation that there's some, like, nuclear codes or whatever in there, then he gets to declare himself vindicated like he did over the Russiagate stuff.
Well, Evelyn, you were in the Pentagon. I agree with Tim that sometimes the media can speculate too much and make it dramatic. But, I mean, Evelyn, why is this kind of speculation important? What's at stake?
I mean, look, I understand Tim's point that it is true that what's at stake here is a law that says that all of these documents belong to the American people. They belong to the U.S. government. And so that journalists like you guys can FOIA them and so that history books have a full accounting. They don't belong to any person or any person's family. So I think that is the core interest right now that the government is pursuing. Having said that, the government needs to look at what risk it has incurred because of the president, and I add, and his staff's actions. Because I'm sorry, even if they were blundering, you know, staffers, somebody packed those boxes. And they also were given an email by Mark Meadows and others, according to the New York Times and other media outlets, stating what the Presidential Records Act expected of them. So there are more people than just Donald Trump culpable for this. So I'm positive there's a full team, interagency team, that is looking at all these documents to look at potential risk and what would be the impact. Because why do I say this? Because, and I have to be careful here, but in the past, when we've had other incidents of huge leaks of classified information, there's generally an intergovernmental task force that looks across the board and assesses what the potential damage to U.S. government interests could be. That is to the United States people, because there are all kinds of things that could be in those documents, including, of course, in one of the ones, WikiLeaks, my passport information was in there, personal information, you know, so
that
is a normal
comforting
thing you do. You have to look at the risk.
Liz, I keep thinking back to what you said about the $3 billion going to Ukraine and how much, you know, what that kind of money could do. Yes, for Ukrainians, but yes, for a lot of people in the United States who are in need. Are we focusing too much on this stuff that we're talking about? I mean, does this whole yet another turn in the Trump saga take us away from deeper problem solving and policy making, or do we have the appetite to do all of that at once?
There are so many obstacles to getting down to actually forcing Congress to legislate. And so many of them are these thick layers of narrative that sort of take precedence over, you know, the actual material of legislation. And one of them is this narrative that it's not that it's unimportant, it matters. You know, about who is going to be in the executive. Is it going to be Donald Trump? And it's a sort of larger narrative about who's going to be in control of the American right wing and what is the shape of the American right going to be? And therefore, you know, what is the right wing path for the American future? And this is something that we spend a lot of time dealing with in the press. It's something we spend a lot of time dealing with culturally. And you know, the left spends, you know, most of its time sort of contending in a reactive way with this American right that's sort of been taking shape over the last 5 years or so at this point. But to the exclusion of, frequently, I think, sort of a real sort of grappling with what the conditions are for a lot of Americans on the ground, which are pretty rough, pretty bad.
Tim, is there a conservative version of this? Like, I mean, are Republicans in Congress and conservatives enjoying this rushing to Trump's defense every time this happens, or would they be prefer to be focusing on larger policy questions and, I don't know, other stuff?
So there's a lot of things going on. I think if you were to like sort of create composite congressional Republicans, one would be the guy who's trying, who wishes he could get the band back together. You know, let's go ahead and figure out how we can simplify the tax code. Let's go ahead and see how we can, you know, pass this conservative reform or address the deficit or whatever. But then another was a bunch of people who kind of believed what they believed and thought the Republican Party and the Republican electorate was one thing. And then Donald Trump came in and showed them that it was something else. That it was a lot more populist, that it was a lot more interested in that the culture war was something different. It wasn't abortion and gay marriage, but it was like, you know, can you punch CNN in the face? And so that class of congressmen that was totally shocked by what Donald Trump revealed has been on its heels because they do not understand their electorate. And the only thing they can latch onto is the man himself, Donald Trump. Those people do not like it. They're trying to hang on to the tail of a tiger that they know could eat them any second. And then there's the Marjorie Taylor Greens, et cetera, who said, oh, completely insane, narcissistic conspiracy theorists can run our country. I'm going to join Congress. So the people who kind of want to be regular Republican politicians are terrified, and the people who want to be conservative policymakers are depressed. Then you got Mitch McConnell in there, and I'm not going to try to get inside his brain. It's probably not good for me to try to get inside that brain.
Evelyn, let me give you the last word here. It should Americans be hanging on to every development when it comes to like these classified documents and so forth, as someone who had access to many of them, like, can we tell people that you don't have to think about this story and this saga every second of your life?
So I'm actually, you're leading the witness, but I'm actually going to resist your lead.
Do it.
I do agree with Liz, and I think I can bridge between what you are trying to lead me to and what she was saying, which is, look, the reason this matters, okay, well, number one, the media does hype it because Donald Trump sells ads and gets eyeballs on the TV, let's just face it. So it's much more compelling than showing children starving on television, which is vitamins that we all need and we need to be confronted with. But unfortunately, the media hasn't figured out a way to, you know, compel people to watch that. And so the bridging argument is that we have a very strong executive in this country, and unfortunately, we're now seeing that Congress isn't even able to stand up to a populist in the White House very effectively or as effectively as we would like. And all of these decisions about whether these children get health care and food and whether we address our income disparity, economic disparity in our country, and all of the problems that we experience as Americans can only be solved by our government, frankly. It's not going to be a private sector thing or individuals. It has to be done, led by government. And we have a strong executive. So it does matter who comes into the White House. And we do have to prevent, you know, I'm channeling now Liz Cheney and others, you know, we do have to prevent a populist like Trump, and specifically Trump, from coming back into office, because these problems will not be solved. He will just continue to divide the country. And where the foreigners come into this is that malicious foreign countries, that is to say countries that want the U.S. democracy and the U.S. as a state to fail economically, politically, militarily, they are actively every day working to get involved in our internal debates about what happens with Donald Trump and what happens with classified documents and how Americans see all these things. So I think it is important for media to focus on this, but not at the exclusion of other important issues.
You bridged successfully, and I hope even though I led you as a witness, you'll come back.
Absolutely, anytime.
All right. That's our special guest, Evelyn Farkas. She's executive director at the McCain Institute and former deputy assistant secretary of defense. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. We also have Tim Carney and Elizabeth Brunig, and we will be back to talk about student debt forgiveness on Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we are back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, David Green, coming to you from the center. On the right, we have Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner. And on the left, we have Elizabeth Bruning, staff writer at the Atlantic. So if you're someone struggling with student debt, making hard financial choices because of the weight of those loans, maybe you got some good news this week. President Biden announced he would cancel $10,000 in debt for people earning less than $125,000, $20,000 canceled for those who receive Pell Grants that go to low-income families. Liz Bruning, I know this has been an issue you've felt strongly about all along. I want to just start with you. Is this Biden announcement what you've been waiting for?
It's something. I mean, it's a move in the right direction. It's going to make a big difference for people who are on income-based repayment. It's going to make a big difference for people who have these sort of enormous sums of student debt that we hear about that sort of mount over time. It's going to take a big chunk out of that. It's tailored to make an especially big difference for Pell Grant recipients. These are some of the poorest people who go to college. So I appreciate it in that respect as well. So, you know, it's a thoughtful policy. It's well done. Does it eliminate the problem altogether? No, but combined with the freeze in student debt repayment that was in place for several months due to COVID, you know, it's one of the better things that's come out of the Biden administration so far.
Tim?
The president does not have legal authority to spend $500 billion.
Well, the administration's linked it to this 2003 law that was helping people in the military.
Hopefully somebody has standing to challenge it, because we're not in an emergency that in any way acutely affects student debt holders right now, it's the best possible time to be a debt holder because of the massive inflation that the pandemic inspired. The government response to the pandemic caused this inflation, which makes it easier to hold debt because the essential value of that debt is going down. Beyond that, you have the fact that college graduates have a 2% unemployment rate. Even if you take into account people who didn't finish college but took on debt, their unemployment rate is—they're at full employment. Their wages are rising. There is not an acute emergency that affects people's ability to pay student loans.
But, I mean, presidents have used laws to say they're acute emergencies for years. I mean, this is not a new from both parties.
Oh, yeah, no, and it's an abuse of power. And exactly as we said in the last segment, our executive is getting too strong. It is a job of Congress to spend money. This wouldn't pass Congress. Nancy Pelosi explicitly said that the president can't do it by himself, and she was trying to get it through Congress, did not have the votes. I think the long-term effects of this, not only do you fuel inflation by shoving a lot more spending power into the economy without any correlating increase in productivity, but you also make it more likely then that the Fed is going to raise interest rates by driving this inflation. So people who are not the direct beneficiaries of this are going to suffer. And the direct beneficiaries of this are, on average, not people who are suffering, but are people with above average wages, below a class with below average unemployment. This is the farthest thing from a targeted policy to help suffering people. And just after bragging that they're reducing the deficit and supposedly reducing inflation, which nobody believed, now they just do this massive injection of $500 billion that they probably don't have the legal authority to do. It's an indefensible policy.
Well, I have like 9 different things I want to ask now. Liz, do you buy first the argument that maybe this is an issue of abuse of power when it comes to all presidents? I mean, finding ways to do things like this without congressional approval.
I mean, it's nice when the agency that's unilaterally legislating and changing the things I can legally do or that happen to me legally is, you know, involves figures who I voted for or at least had the opportunity to vote for, as opposed to the Supreme Court. Oftentimes in this country, the people who are legislating what happens to me, I had no control over who they are. So in this case, I appreciate that the, you know, abuse of power is at least marginally related to some kind of democratic control. Thank you. Benevolent abuse of power in this case.
That's a new phrase. What about Tim's point that this really is not helping the people who need it most? Because that does, the numbers do seem to bear that out, that this...
Yeah, it's not an anti-poverty program, and it's not being sold as an anti-poverty program. I mean, there are different kinds of aid programs that exist. For instance, programs that are tailored to babies are not tailored to poor people either, nor are they tailored to disabled people. You could say that every program that is tailored to babies is not going to people who are suffering the most from poverty. That's true. They're going to people who are suffering the most from being newborns. This is going to people who are suffering the most from student debt. And student debt, I think, presents a number of unique challenges to people. I think it's an explanation especially for this sort of unique phenomenon of millennial failure to launch, which was compounded by the pandemic. So you had a lot of people around about my age, I'm 31 years old, who, you know, when the pandemic hit in about late 2019, early 2020, were kind of trying to launch or making their best effort, and then everything shut down. Job markets became, you know, very, very fragile. People lost work. People were looking for work. People lost a lot of money. People had to move home, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a sort of regress that I think struck people my age very hard in terms of getting their lives and careers going, finding mates and starting families. And so I think student debt has come up quite frequently in conversations like that about what's in the way of sort of millennials sort of getting started and making their own way and building up their own financial assets and so forth. And so in that respect, I think student debt has been a sort of major societal problem. And so I think resolving it is certainly makes sense as a government priority.
Tim, I'll try to find a little bit of overlap with what Liz was saying there.
Oh, good.
I want somebody to do a study here, because this started to get close to something I care a lot about, which is that millennials don't have enough babies, right? And I interview a lot of them, and I say, you know, what do you think about having kids? Oh, I can't afford it. And student debt is one of the top things they mention. I'm skeptical that forgiving student debt will change that, but maybe it will. And then you could make me warmer to this policy. If you could find, and you'd have to, the study is, you know, the study construct is beyond my own skills as a journalist here, but do a study. Did people who got their debt forgiven, were they more likely to have more babies and to have babies sooner? That if you had Biden come out and make the pronatal case and say, we're going to start to get a baby boom in mid-2023 because of this. That would be something that could start to get me to overlook all the various
possibilities. Why is that your focus? Why is that?
Because right now we have fewer children in America than we did at the last census. Because I think that millennials are harmed by not forming families. And I think that my generation, Generation X, is really going to be harmed when we go into retirement and there's not enough people in the workforce. America has a real demographic problem where we're not making enough babies. Birth rates are at a record low. And if student debt really is a contributor, then my opposition to this policy, if you could show me that this would change things around, I would become a little less cold to this policy.
I mean, can I just say what bothers me about the conversation around this policy? One, I think that any argument that it is going to stimulate the economy is false advertising from some Democrats. I think the fear-mongering on the right that this is going to add to inflation, I mean, Tim, even American Enterprise, I mean, some of your colleagues have said that any impact on inflation is going to be minimal, because it's not like people who get this debt relief are going to go spending tons of money. They're probably going to go spending the money to bring down other loans. Like, maybe this is the kind of policy that, Tim, as you were saying, like, it's modest, it's worth trying, it solves a problem for some people, but, and we can study it and see what the effect is and understand, you know, the pain of debt in our country and what impact
is that. The problem with that is the chaos that this creates.
What's the chaos?
The chaos is that people now don't know whether taking out a loan in the future is going to require them to repay it. So you get more people borrowing money no understanding, no expectation that they are going to have to pay it in the future.
But that was always the case. You didn't have to pay back loans if you took certain jobs in the nonprofit industry. I mean, you never knew you had to pay them back.
That's going from, but, and then colleges are likely going to raise tuition, because the expected ability to pay
goes up. There's just a moral hazard created when we're saying the president, when he likes to, a few months before a midterm election, can choose a class of people that's going to have some of what they owe wiped out. That just creates a disordered system. And I think that the long-term costs of this are almost impossible to predict. This is why I'm a conservative, right? I think really massive disruptions to very complicated systems have large consequences, and those large consequences are unpredictable and usually bad.
Do you see risk in this policy, Liz? I mean, even if you support it, do you see risks in sort of the category that Tim is talking about?
In a debt jubilee? No. No. I don't see a risk, no.
Well, let me use the example of university presidents. I mean, do we know that they're going to raise prices for college? I mean, I don't.
So
that sounds speculative. Like going back to a word that you used earlier in the show.
Tuition subsidies tend to, and different types have different effects, but tuition subsidies tend to at least partially go to raising tuitions. When the Obama administration increased the amount of federal student loans, multiple studies showed that about half of that money, or at least 40% of that money, went to just padding the pockets of the university, which were not like an impoverished class. About half of it did benefit the students and their parents. But when you subsidize attending college, the money doesn't all just go to those students who are getting the subsidies. Some of it goes to the lenders when it was in the private sector. Some of it's going to go to the university. Some of it's going to get passed down to other people. And so just that means that the people who aren't getting this benefit are going to see their tuition go up, unless the next time a Democrat's in the White House at the midterms, they decide to do another targeted debt jubilee.
So this just means that, you know, if university presidents decide to make certain tuition increases, people who come along and enter college after this debt forgiveness moment might encounter higher prices.
Yeah, that will have higher prices for people. And then
I thought it was the case that higher ed was understood to just sort of be inflating in price across the board.
It is, and everything's getting more expensive in higher ed more than other things. But subsidies for college increase the price tag of college, and the people who get below median subsidies are going to see extraordinary increases in
unless the prices are going up in an extraordinary way anyway. I mean, I think that's Liz, the point you're making. Independently of this debt relief, prices for college are going to go up no matter what.
Right. I wouldn't dispute that there are serious problems with the pricing in higher ed, and I think that calls for a sort of legal intervention, especially if this is going to be key to how our economy functions, getting this credential, which I find a little ridiculous.
I think we agree.
All right, we'll end it on a moment of agreement. we'll leave it there on our conversation. Obviously, we'll be following this policy as it's implemented and debated into the midterms. Okay, we've reached that time once again for our famous left, right, and center rants. We feature pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tim, I'm going to give you the soapbox first.
The Justice Department issued a press release this month responding to threats made against a transgender health program at Boston Children's Hospital. It's worrisome that our culture wars increasingly involve threats and violence, and so it's baffling that DOJ has not said a single word about the campaign of arson, vandalism, and violent threats against pro-life pregnancy centers. The day after the U.S. attorney in Boston issued her statement about Boston Children's, vandals attacked Bethlehem House in East Hampton, Mass., leaving behind the threat, quote, "If abortions aren't safe, neither are you." A few weeks earlier, vandals smashed the windows of the pro-life Clearway Clinic in Worcester. Senator Elizabeth Warren has called for the abolition of pro-life clinics in Massachusetts and, quote, "all around the country." And these attacks are happening all around the country. But if we care for babies and for mothers in tough pregnancies, we should want them to have as many options as possible, and we should protect those options from extremists who will use violence to wipe out any alternative to abortion.
Okay, Liz, the soapbox is yours.
In Finland, Prime Minister Sanna Marin has come under fire recently for partying. At an after party at a music festival, she was caught on tape by some of her friends dancing in a manner that suggested to her Finnish friends and followers that she might be using drugs. Recently, a photo was posted on a Finsta, apparently by a friend of hers, which showed a couple of pals at her official residence topless, kissing. One of them was wearing a cowboy hat. Looked like a fun night. I think they should just let her live. She's not doing anything wrong. She's in her early 30s. She still has friends who come from her pre-political life. Honestly, I think that's awesome, and it bespeaks a much healthier political culture than we have. Leave Santa alone.
All right, I'm also going to rant about letting people alone. I'm going to rant about vacations, which I like in general a lot. But did you follow this glorious Rick Scott moment? The Republican Florida senator ridicule President Biden, saying another week of President Biden vacationing in Delaware versus working at the White House. If he loves travel so much, I've got suggestions as to where he should go next. How about a luxury yacht in Italy? What do you think of that suggestion, Senator Scott? Because that is exactly where you were when you sent this tweet. It's really unreal here. After that snafu, why don't we stop the vacation attacks altogether forever? Bush 41 in Kennebunkport, Obama in Hawaii, Bush 43 in Crawford, Texas, Trump Mar-a-Lago with his safe. We get it. Presidents and politicians vacation. Come on, at least President Biden was just a train ride away from work. Okay, that's all we have for today. I want to thank Tim Carney and Elizabeth Brunig, as always. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Our production assistant is Alexandra Applegate. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. I'm David Green. Appreciate you joining us, and come back next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.